This podcast is intended for investment professionals only.
Hello and welcome to this CIO market update from LGIM. I'm Max Julius, Head of Content, and I'm delighted to be joined by Sonia Lau, CIO, Amelia Tan, Head of Responsible Investment Strategy, and Alexander Burr, ESG Policy Lead within our Investment Stewardship team. Good afternoon, everyone, and welcome to the pod.
Good afternoon, Max.
Good afternoon.
Well, I'm very excited to return to LGIM Talks after some brief paternity leave. And looking back on the past month or so, it's been a relatively quiet summer for markets. But there have been some notable developments, such as Treasury yields hitting multi-year highs and increasing investor bearishness over China. So, Sonia, with no further ado, what's the outlook for risk assets into year end?
Thank you, Max, and a very warm welcome to our listeners. Very good question, and I'm sure a lot of investors are pondering on this question when you look at equity markets in particular that have actually been able to accelerate again through the summer, particularly as you highlighted, not necessarily China, but when you look at the US and the Nasdaq in particular, there was a renewed hype, particularly on AI-related stocks. NVIDIA has hit a new record high and has obviously led to an increase in the overall index level. It's not been a level playing field, though, and the questions that investors need to answer remain the same, which is, are central banks done yet? I.e., have we been able to tame inflation? And are we seeing inflation at least plateauing, if not reducing? And then secondly, if that the case, what will be the impact of the interest rate hikes on the overall economy? And as you recall, and for our regular listeners, you will recall on previous calls, we have outlined that clearly the US has been far more robust than anticipated. And we've had an upside surprise, particularly in the second quarter numbers, to the upside, which, as we've learned now in hindsight, has been mostly driven by fiscal stimulus. So there's a lot in the underlying data that we need to understand, but we stick to our assessment that interest rates will work and will bring or will allow the economy to slow down. But so the remaining question clearly is by how much and when. And timing clearly has not been our friend. We have been wrong with our original assessment that we expected the recession to happen in the second half of this year. We are now pushing this to the first quarter of next year, but we are sticking with our underlying assessment that interest rates and in particular the transmission mechanism, i.e. tighter bank credit, will inevitably lead to the necessary slowdown, which inevitably will lead to inflation approaching target again and allowing central banks then on the back of that reduced economic activity to cut interest rates. That, and obviously a very long-winded answer to your question, would lead to lower risk asset prices, inevitably, because what will happen then is that equity revisions will turn negative, and then you look at current valuations, particularly in the US, and you would have to wonder how we can sustain equity prices at these levels. Now, everything I've just said was very much US-centric. The picture is different already in Europe and the UK, where we've had a flurry of economic data that was on the weaker side, particularly in Europe. Germany has once again been earmarked as the sick man of Europe, interestingly, with record high wage inflation data. So the ECB is probably facing a more difficult balancing act than the Fed. And the UK, likewise, still has the highest inflation data across the G7. And the Bank of England is still expected to add one or potentially two more hikes. So it's a slightly different version of the same picture. But clearly, in the UK and Europe, we're seeing probably a faster transmission mechanism. But we should not forget that it's been the energy shock and the direct impact this had had on Europe and the UK that made it a slightly different pathway to compare to the US. You have mentioned China, and we would be amiss not to focus on China because it's very clear that the real estate, the property crunch is really taking a toll on the underlying economic data. And so we have seen actually the equity market and the bond market being the weakest across the globe in the context if we now compare Europe, UK, US and now China, but very much on the back of economic data. There is now the discussion on what the government can do. It's very important to understand, and this is why I've mentioned the property crunch, that we are facing a balance sheet recession, i.e. you have to work through a level of overinvestment in property that preceded the current environment. And as such, stimulus will not work. That's very important. We have seen this in other countries play out. But that means that the government cannot use, you know, interest rates as the first lever. We will have to see probably broader fiscal stimulus in order to support the economy. But that remains to be seen. We haven't heard anything major yet. And so what is currently playing out is the weakness we're seeing in the property market, obviously having a big impact on the overall economic activity. So that's what we are seeing. So we stick to where we were before, where, again, I have to admit we have been wrong because risk assets have been incredibly strong up to now, again, with the very strong performance of technology stocks. So we have to caveat this a little bit. But we stick that it would be wrong at this point now to buy into risk assets with everything I've outlined on the economic picture. We believe that actually government bonds will offer a better risk return profile. And so it's more a risk of positioning. We stick to it and we'll still expect better entry points into risk assets at a later stage.
Thank you, Sonia, for that very comprehensive overview of the dynamics moving markets right now. I think it's absolutely right to be transparent when we get things wrong, as well as when we get things right with our investors and listeners. Alex, this is a great point to bring you into the conversation. And of course, we're away from markets. We're in the midst of a campaign by Lewis Pugh, UN Patron of the Oceans and LGIM's global partner. He's swimming down the Hudson River to highlight the risks posed by biodiversity loss. And last year, we saw the conclusion of the UN's Global Biodiversity Framework, the global agreements that will manage our relationship with nature through to 2050. Why does the stewardship team think this issue is so important?
Thank you, Max. You're quite right that as a team, we have decided to put nature as one of our six strategically important themes. Why is that? Well, to put it simply, it is a topic we believe to be fundamental to the long-term health of our economic and social system. We see it as integral to the UN's sustainable development goals, but we also that it covers vital aspects of our daily lives, from the food we eat to the air we breathe. To give you some numbers on nature, albeit quite a difficult task, the World Economic Forum has estimated that half of global GDP is highly or moderately dependent on nature. Unfortunately, we and many others notice and realize that the natural world is in crisis. So ecosystems are being degraded at a faster rate than ever before. Some scientists are proposing that we're entering something which has been called the sixth mass extinction. So if we continue down this path, ecosystems are being pushed to complex tipping points that are resulting potentially in some complete ecosystem collapse. Now, the reason I raise this is that the World Bank has estimated that loss of ecosystem services could decline annual GDP of around $2.7 trillion by 2030. So with all that context, what I'm trying to underline here is that, in essence, our relationship with nature needs to change. We must acknowledge that our economies are embedded in nature and not external to it. So therefore, we're seeing this as nature and the topics which fall underneath that, including biodiversity, as a systemic market risk of which we must engage on. You also mentioned the Global Biodiversity Framework, incredibly important agreement there, which was agreed in Montreal last year. That is the international treaty or agreement that aims to restore and protect nature by 2050. So if you look in the climate space, we had the Paris Agreement. We can look in nature. This is the Montreal Agreement.
Thank you, Alex. You just painted a very bleak picture for us, but highlighted the importance of the issue. How are you engaging on behalf of our clients to tackle the challenges you've outlined?
Thanks, Max. I could give you a few areas, but one I think is incredibly important and one relevant at this month. So, as I said, the economic system at the moment perhaps has not been putting a value on nature and perhaps has been overlooking it. It often goes unpriced and therefore the externalities become unaccounted for. So nature-related risks are not being priced in. How do we change that? Well, we've been engaging with policymakers, governments, including in Montreal, to mandate companies, both across the public and private sector, to report against their impact and dependencies on nature. How we do that? Well, there is a framework which is being developed and hopefully released later in September, called the Task Force for Nature-Related Financial Disclosures. It is a similar framework to that of the TCFD. It will hopefully guide companies through understanding what their impacts, dependencies, risks and opportunities are to nature-related topics. I could go on into another area which is incredibly important and was raised in Montreal as well, around agricultural subsidies, of which we've just written to the G20 of how to reform agricultural subsidies in a way which is aligned with nature and climate commitments. And the reason why I note this, these are vast financial programs with the agricultural sector contributing to 11% of greenhouse gas emissions. It's an incredibly important area which is often goes overlooked.
Thanks, Alex. Well, Amelia, Alex has just talked about pricing and he's mentioned quite a few risks related to biodiversity. What are the investment implications of biodiversity loss, and what are we doing to mitigate these risks and capture the opportunities?
Thanks, Max. Yeah, Alex rightly pointed out the TNFD, and I think that greater disclosure will actually enable greater scrutiny by investors. So I think investors welcome that development. And he also mentioned the Montreal Agreement. And I think with this, we have already observed and we anticipate a ramp up on policy action globally. One example is the EU deforestation-free products regulation to be implemented next year. This is really set to ensure that products that are imported or exported from the EU have not been produced on land that was deforested after 31st of December 2020. So these would include products such as cattle, cocoa, palm oil, soya, wood, and their downstream products. So what this then means is that traceability becomes important, and companies who are negatively implicated, whether directly or indirectly, through their supply chains, could be subject to fines of at least 4% of annual turnover. Now, for any company, this could be significant financially. And so this becomes a material concern for any investor to have. It's not all downside risk, thankfully. There are some investment opportunities as well that investors can consider. So, for example, companies that support activities to mitigate the biodiversity impact, whether directly or indirectly. So, for example, companies that provide irrigation solutions, companies that provide natural or scientifically based replacements for synthetic chemicals used in high-value crops, companies that enable the circular economy, you know, things like metals recycling or even reverse vending machines for refillable and non-refillable beverage containers. So these are really interesting investment opportunities that we can consider as investors. There are also emerging financial instruments. Debt for nature swaps is a good one. So these are basically financial mechanisms that forgive a developing country's foreign debt in exchange for commitments to invest in biodiversity conservation. And actually, LGIM bought $250 million of the largest ever debt for nature swap for Ecuador. And that transaction allowed Ecuador to exchange over $1 billion, so I think it was to the likes of $1.6 billion worth of bonds, for a $656 million loan at a much lower repayment rate. So, and this is on condition that the country must spend over $300 million on marine conservation in the Galapagos Islands. So that's good news and win-win story for all.
That's really interesting, Amelia. So there is ground for optimism. There are things that investors can do on this front. Sonia, taking a step back, there's been a dramatic acceleration in investor thinking on ESG and regulatory frameworks globally in recent years. How do we reflect on these changes from the perspective of a global asset manager?
Thanks, Max. I think this is an incredibly important question, because if you just consider what both Amelia and Alex have just shared, these are not topics we would have discussed a couple of years ago. So we're talking about a fundamental shift in the way our clients engage with us and what the expectations are, how we invest money on behalf of our clients. And we have seen a flurry of regulatory change. We expect even more regulatory change going forward. And this is all changes that have occurred over the best part of, 3 to 5 years, if you really focus on the big changes in the regulatory landscape and our understanding and the shifts in client demand. This has never happened before in the context of the investment industry and how you consider an appropriate investment within a specific investment context. Now, in addition, if you consider the global remit of LGIM and obviously a lot of other asset managers and our clients, we are unfortunately not facing a homogeneous approach to responsible investing, which creates very often quite a tense environment. Obviously, the US is probably the one country everybody's looking towards because it has morphed into an incredible politicized debate where we are seeing real pushback towards the understanding and the principles that particularly in Europe have been developed. And that puts extra complexity. It requires, point one, a very clear articulation of what we stand for, what the philosophy is, what the principles are that we apply for, and a very transparent communication with clients and obviously with policymakers, with regulators, and all other relevant stakeholders to make sure that we're not losing sight of what we're here to achieve. And I think that is important to reflect on and make sure that the investment teams and the investment stewardship team work very well together and that everyone is equipped to have the right knowledge. And we should not forget the upskilling is mostly related to a level of knowledge that we didn't use in the past. When I started, we didn't have a climate solutions team. We didn't have experts on nature, on biodiversity loss, on even on key topics like equality and diversity. When I started, they were known, but it was clearly not a topic that you would put forward when you sit in front of a CEO. So there's a real shift in the way how you analyze a company. And then we come to probably the most important change. You have to be able to measure it. So the request for data has exploded in a way that puts a real burden on the companies we engage with. It puts a real burden on our teams to understand, to reflect, and to quantify them. But at the end of the day, are the proof that what we are measuring is actually relevant, is quantifiable, and has an impact on the outcome of the investment thesis. So massive change, which I believe is incredibly exciting, but we should not underestimate that the changes that we have all been through will still evolve and will require careful attention and reflection on what has been happening, in particular because there will be, to some extent, negative headlines and lots of pushback because we're not talking about a global level playing field.
Yeah, really interesting. It would be fascinating to return to this question in a year or two to see how things stand there. But my takeaways are transparency, upskilling, and measurability as well. Well, Alex, another theme that's key to Lewis's swim is the future of water. What's the stewardship team's latest thinking on this subject, which is also clearly of huge environmental significance?
Thank you, Max. You're absolutely right. It is an incredibly important area. It's an important area on the environmental side, but it also reaches right across some of our other themes, so health and social aspects too. So we've discussed a bit about our sort of higher level approach to nature and the way of which we're looking at it as well. We can split that up into different thematic areas, one of which is water. It's an area of which we can all relate to. It's incredibly important, but it's absolutely fundamental to get strong and robust global freshwater systems to meet our climate and nature-related commitments, both in Paris and in Montreal, as we discussed. Unfortunately, it's an increasingly scarce resource. It's undervalued, underpriced, as we discussed earlier. You know, climate change is worsening that further through extreme weather events, whether that be droughts or whether that be increased flooding. And it can have very wide relating impacts right across a company's value chain, anywhere from energy production to, you know, apparel. So the way of which we're researching right now on what we want to do, there's definitely a way in which we'd like to take it. Because in the UK, I think we've taken a lot of time has been given towards the pollution aspect of water. Whilst absolutely critical, and we have actually been doing quite a lot of work on that for microplastic pollution, etc., it misses another aspect, which is water scarcity. So if you are going to have a water secure policy and system in the UK and globally, then you need to be approaching both of those quantity and quality aspects. That aspect is, we're still in research phase. We're looking at collaborating in this space with the likes of Ceres. They have a valuing water finance initiative we're being part of there. There's other aspects to it. So it's not just a company engagement. As mentioned earlier, it's a policy engagement, whether there's the right water security policies and plans in place. We've worked with CDP on that in the past. And one I'd like to say as well is that part of the health work we've been looking at over the past year has been around antimicrobial resistance within the water system. And we've been engaging the G7 on that as it's not tackled desperately well. There's an incredible amount of antimicrobial resistance within the system. It's not being addressed. It's not part of the wastewater production and processes. It's not even on their radar. So that's been part of what we've been doing as well. And we hope to build that out in the coming months and year.
Thanks, Alex. Amelia, this is a very broad final question for you, but given concerns over greenwashing, and as Sonia has just highlighted, the growing politicization of the debate, do you think we've reached peak ESG?
Well, in my view, I'd say it's a resounding no. I think, you know, Sonia mentioned this rapid pace of development. And I think it's very natural when things have evolved so quickly for people to take stock, to determine whether or not this is the right path forward, to see if things have been done, you know, in a way that reflects their views and their beliefs, right? So from that perspective, I think in terms of client demand, certainly the challenges in the US market come to mind. Mm. But that said, if we think about it more broadly across the rest of the world, I would want to highlight actually that I see the nature of client demand to be changing. I think it's actually becoming much more sophisticated. And that in itself doesn't reflect this notion of peak ESG. So to give you an example, when we first started talking to clients about this concept of ESG, things were really about very basic exclusions, right? Over time, you see that the interest from investors has become more about, you know, moving into portfolios and strategies that align towards what I call ESG winners and away from losers. Most recently, you've now seen yet another evolution where clients are recognizing that they cannot afford to ignore the laggards. In fact, they are now trying to tackle, you know, these problems head on by targeting laggard companies directly, taking positions in them, and using deep engagement to improve companies' approach to critical issues, and at the same time, unlock shareholder value. I think this evolution in investors' objectives is actually to be very encouraging, and I think that these are the kinds of strategies that will bring about the change that is needed to solve, you know, the world's biggest challenges like climate change. From an investment thesis perspective, I think the investment rationale as well for considering sustainability issues is, if anything, becoming greater than before. We've talked about the increasing disclosure today, and we've talked about global policy actions in biodiversity. You know, a lot of coordination. There has been a lot of development on things like climate change policies, right? Whether it's the US Inflation Reduction Act or the EU's Green Deal, these will have significant impact on the attractiveness of business models on a go-forward basis. We know Wall Street analysts are upgrading their earnings estimates by 5 to 10% based on expected tax credit benefits, for example, in the US. And according to some researchers in the EU, the policies behind the Green Deal could benefit anywhere from hundreds to thousands of companies across the entire supply chain. If we think about the social front, there are implications as well, where we're seeing greater scrutiny on labor practices of companies and their supply chains. So, for example, the US is ramping up enforcement of the Uyghur Forced Labor Prevention Act. They're expanding coverage of products ranging from anywhere from the flooring sector to the auto sector. On the demand side also, if you think about consumer behavior, it's also becoming much more focused on sustainability, and companies that recognize this stand a better chance of ensuring the durability of their businesses. So a good example here is soft drink companies. So successful soft drink companies have been and continue to diversify their portfolios away from sugar-led drinks, right? Reformulating their beverages to address consumers' need for both taste and health consciousness. And so these considerations on sustainability issues really should become more and more relevant to investors.
Thanks, Amelia. That's a very clear and resounding no to the question. And I think it really resonates, Alex, with the urgency of the points you were making there about the specific issues of biodiversity and water. Well, Sonia, as always, we've covered a huge amount of ground today. Is there anything you'd like to add before we wrap up?
Yes, given the focus of today's session, I think it's worth just really reflecting on the implication for the way investors should think about their asset allocation and how sustainability themes will influence their choices and the success of their investment strategy. And I think particularly because we covered topics that probably are not mainstream today, I think it's always worth thinking about the structural changes that will occur and will influence the attractiveness of investments. And we have obviously talked a lot about thematics in the past, and I believe that it's a good way in order to express views and values to think about how those structural themes could benefit the overall asset allocation. Likewise, I think we have to consider the structural changes for existing companies, right? A lot of these topics probably are still dependent on new innovation and R&D to help and support and improve the issues that we have highlighted. But again, that's all opportunities. So given that I've been so clear on our risk positioning earlier, I always like to highlight that opportunity sets, despite the fact we are clearly starting from a fundamental economic macro backdrop, the opportunity set based on the structural changes that we have been discussing today and that are so broad, because we haven't even touched on geopolitical risk and all the other related drivers. But understanding these, I think, will be far more important in the future in terms of selecting investable themes and areas that will outperform potentially just the broad economic backdrop.
Well, thanks. That's a great long-term point on which to end this month's call. Finally, I'd just like to ask each one of you what you've been watching, reading, or listening to recently. I'll get the ball rolling and say I've just read Dynasty by the historian Tom Holland. It's all about the Caesars, and it reads like a thriller. It's great, fun stuff. Sonia, over to you.
Great, thanks, Max. I have been reading a very interesting book called Chip Wars by Chris Miller, and I had the immense pleasure sitting next to Chris Miller at a dinner. And it's the history of the semiconductor industry. And it's obviously such an important industry and such a unique industry, because most of our listeners might know that Taiwan actually produces 90% of the high-performance chips. So you rarely have an input factor that is so broadly used And literally the world economy is dependent upon, it's produced by one company in one country. But it's fascinating to understand the starting points and how the US in particular has been engaging post-World War II with Japan, who is actually leader in memory chips. Absolutely fascinating. But obviously with the context of the importance of Taiwan and TSMC in this. And obviously, I think we had a first indication during the pandemic, what happens if you just disrupt that supply chain, because as we know, it's everything, right? From nobody can produce mobile phones, cars, and literally everything comes to a standstill. So if you consider a more prolonged disruption, obviously in the geopolitical context, and amazing in terms of the important figures and the drivers and the brilliance, amazing.
A timely read.
Yes.
And Amelia, what have you been consuming of late?
So I've been listening to the Audible books of the basically a trilogy on Greek mythology written and narrated by Stephen Fry. And it has been absolutely fascinating. First of all, he's fantastic at narrating. I mean, like, you cannot believe that that is one person. And also, it's just amazing because you forget or you don't really realize how embedded Greek mythology is in our daily lives and how we explain the world. It's just fascinating. For example, how the bee got its sting. You know, that's the kind of thing that, you know, we have as early people, I suppose, tried to explain the world and how creative we as the humans have been in trying to do this. So I certainly recommend that.
Thanks. He has a wonderful actor and I'm sure narrator too. Alex, over to you.
Thanks, Max. In between my baby week by week books, which are perhaps a little off topic, there's a really interesting book by Dieter Helm called Green and Prosperous Land. It was written in 2019. It's covering a lot of what we've talked about around nature. It's obviously focused on the UK, and it looks at how we can, a lot, again, what we talked about and what the Skipta review spoke about is how we can put a value on nature. And what's wrong with current system, policies and regulations not being implemented. It's a brilliant book, very clear. Obviously, I'm not all the way through it just yet, but it is start. I thought the start was brilliant. It was a quote from Joni Mitchell. It was like, you don't know what you've lost till it's gone, and they paved paradise to put up a parking lot. I thought it was a brilliant start.
Sounds great. Well, as always, a really good set of recommendations for our listeners. I'm actually also reading the baby week by week book as well right now. We can take that one offline. Well, look, on that note, let's wrap up today. Thank you, Sonia, Amelia and Alex, for your time. Thank you to you, our clients and listeners, for joining us. Our next edition of the CIO call will be in late September, when Sonia will be joined by Tim Drayson and Jason Shoup to assess the US policy outlook. In the meantime, you can find our latest updates via our social media channels, on the LGIM blog, and of course, here on LGIM Talks.
As a reminder, this podcast is intended for investment professionals only and shouldn't be shared with a non-professional audience. This podcast should not be taken as an invitation to deal in legal and general investments. Any views expressed during this recording belong to the individuals and are based on market conditions at the time of the recording and do not reflect the views of legal and general investment management. Forward-looking statements are, by their nature, subject to significant risks and uncertainties and are based on internal forecasts and assumptions and should not be relied upon. Where individual stocks are mentioned, these do not constitute a recommendation to buy or sell any security and are for illustrative purposes only. Legal & General Investment Management Limited is authorised and regulated by the Financial Conduct Authority. For full terms and conditions, please visit our website. To find more content, you can check us out on Twitter, LinkedIn, and our website. Copyright 2023. Legal & General Investment Management Limited. All rights reserved. No part of this publication may be reproduced or transmitted in any form or by any means, including photocopying and recording, without the written permission of the publishers. This material is issued by Legal and General Investment Management Asia Limited, the licensed corporation BBB 488, regulated by the Hong Kong Securities and Futures Commission, for professional investors only.